Hobbyists and Atheists is reaching a fever pitch. Some seek to find common understanding and agreement. This is a place where we begin with differences and end with similarities. This is Apologia.
Hello and welcome to Apologia. My name is Zachary Moore, and I'll be moderating and participating in the discussion today. As always, Apologia is a group of theists and atheists who are here for a friendly roundtable discussion about our different perspectives and where we can find agreement. If you happen to have feedback for the discussion, you can give it at the website for this podcast, which is hosted at drzach.net. Today we have Kevin Harris, who is the Minister of Apologetics at the First Baptist Church of Colleyville and also is the co-host of the Reasonable Faith podcast with Dr. William Lane Craig. We also have John Wilson, who is a student of philosophy and a seminarian at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And we also have Dan Sawyer, who's the author of Sculpting God, whose work you can find at jdsawyer.net, and who also happens to be the co-host of the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Gentlemen, welcome to the discussion.
Thank you.
Howdy.
All right. Well, today we're going to try to bring to a close the collected arguments and evidences that we've been presenting in favor of the Jesus myth hypothesis. In our previous two sessions, we've covered the arguments from silence and the arguments from similarity. Just to give a brief summary of these, the first part deals with the tendency of those earliest Christian writings, i.e. the letters of Paul, to not make any explicit mention of the historical details of the life and ministry of Jesus that we've actually been accustomed to through reading of the Gospels. It also notes that there's a lack of any contemporary or near-contemporary corroboration of the historical details mentioned in the Gospels by historians and writers living in the first century who would have been in a position to do so. This section actually raises a question, or at least attempts to raise a question at these facts. Although not able to definitively conclude in favor of mythicism in their own right, it does seek to establish that Jesus has no historical alibi. The next section, the arguments from similarity, deals with the uncanny similarities of the archetypical characteristics of Jesus and the narrative details that are attributed to him with those of other recognized mythical figures that lived prior to or contemporaneous with the early Christian movement. Again, these are interesting and may be meaningful, but are not enough for a mythical conviction just yet. This is, on the whole, circumstantial evidence, even though certain aspects of it are especially compelling. Now, today we're going to examine the arguments from ahistoricity. It's really only now, in this group of arguments and evidences, that we move away from simply pointing out the lack of any historical alibi or the wide array of circumstantial mythical similarities. This is where we establish means, motive, and direct evidence, which is, we feel anyway, is best explained by the veracity of mythicism.
We ought to be clear. Zach and I feel
yeah.
This
when
way.
I say
the
we,
Christians
I mean
on the conference
right.
Do not.
That should be implied. It's no mistake that I'm somewhat forced to use the adversarial language of a legal dispute here, because although the previous two sections are potentially innocuous to someone who wants to maintain a position of historicity, this section is difficult to put it mildly, or anathema even. And so in a sense, we have to petition the Bible itself, or more accurately, the authors and editors from the dawn of Christianity, sort of place them on the witness stand and question them directly as best we're able to. The mythicists here, that is Dan and myself, have it upon ourselves to make this case. Is the testimony of these witnesses best explained by historicity or mythicism? What are the star witnesses themselves, the gospel evangelists? Do they claim to be historical journalists? And does their work actually back up that claim? What about those next in line, the scribes that received the early scriptures? Were they objective copyists, or were they capable of altering what is, to us, the prime historical evidence? And again, returning to our surprise witness, Paul, who we talked about before, although we've shown that he can provide very little in the way of a historical alibi for Jesus, does his own testimony hint at ahistoricity? Now, obviously, these are controversial questions, and this is where the real meat of the issue roasts succulently in the heat of contention, to put it mildly. What we're going to attempt to do today is to bring this issue into focus and to try to arrive at some sort of a truth of reality and maybe get some impressions from the Christians at the table. And I'm sure that the rapport that we've established here is sufficient to allow for some degree of clarity and understanding. So just to drive right into these, the very first one I want to talk about, and maybe Dan, you can elucidate this a little bit, but I want to talk about the fact that Matthew and Mark, the Gospels of Matthew and, or I'm sorry, Matthew and Luke seem to base their accounts on the Gospel of Mark and appear to add extravagant details in a manner that suggests legendary development. And this is, this comes actually from the synoptic problem. Maybe if you can explain what the synoptic problem is in a little bit of detail.
Okay. The synoptic problem is that there are three Gospels which essentially tell the same story and one which tells a different story in terms of the general sequence of events, the emphasis on particular teachings, and the presence of similar stories. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell essentially the same story with varying inflections, while John approaches the gospel material from an entirely different angle. And the Jesus in John, particularly when you get to his life events and his theology, is quite a departure from the Jesus in the other two gospels. The traditional Christian understanding of this difference is that John was writing to refute Gnosticism and therefore was emphasizing different parts of Jesus' life and work. But it does the similarity between the first three Gospels isn't just one of similar narrative timelines or similar events. There actually is quite a bit of common material down to the exact words used.
Right.
Mark, the entire Gospel of Mark, give or take a few paragraphs here and there, is contained within the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. However, the Gospels of Matthew and Luke also contain material common to each other on a word-for-word basis that is not found in Mark, and they contain material dissimilar from each other. The common material they contain that is not found in Mark is referred to as the Q document, which is a hypothetical document that biblical scholars figure they must both have used as reference. There is a good, healthy argument that will probably never be solved about whether Q was in fact a written document or whether it was a common oral tradition. But the similarity in word choice points up the conclusion that if it was a common oral tradition, it had to be a liturgical one where the words were actually memorized rather than the same stories just being told.
And that was the Q source, right?
The Q source, yeah. Q is the first letter of the word Quelle, Q-U-E-L-L-E, which is German for source.
Right. And that was that's what we know about it is that it's primarily sayings. I've heard it referred to as the sayings source also because
when when the Gospel of Thomas was discovered back in the 1930s, 1940s, it was initially assumed that the Gospel of Thomas was Q because it contains a good amount of Q material and it is simply just sayings. However, the Gospel of Thomas is markedly Gnostic and its theology is radically different from any of the canonical Gospels. And there's a significant question over its antiquity because the oldest surviving manuscript copies we have are from the 3rd century and the oldest references we have to it are only from the 2nd century. So there's a lot of contention over whether Thomas is actually Q, but the balance of scholarly opinion leans towards it wasn't, but it was also drawing upon the Q tradition.
Right.
But it's significant in that it does prove that such sayings, documents were in circulation, so it lends weight to the Q hypothesis.
Right. And what you've just described is I've heard that referred to as the two source hypothesis, that you have Mark and Q, which Matthew and Luke both used. There actually are other hypotheses out there to solve the synoptic problem because there are, although I'm not familiar with the details of these particular verses, but there are some that seem to contradict this view, although the vast majority of the verses do seem to line up in favor of the two source hypothesis.
Right. And there have been other hypotheses advocated, particularly over the 20th century. Probably one of the most radical is that of Johannine priority, which holds that John was written first and that the other three were all based upon John in one way or another.
Right.
That was advocated most strongly by J. A. T. Robinson, I believe it was.
Yeah, and there are a couple good examples of this this taking place. I've looked through them, and there actually are some published works where that actually they show all three Gospels sort of synoptically, you know, laid side to side, so you can read them horizontally instead of vertically, which help you to see a lot of these parallels. But there's a few good ones. The first is at the beginning of all the stories, at the baptism of Jesus. You have Mark's, you know, his basic story here, where Jesus comes from Nazareth in Galilee, and he's baptized by John, and he comes out of the water. He sees the heavens open. And the Spirit, like a dove, descends, and a voice comes out from the heavens: "You're my beloved Son, and you I am well pleased." Luke basically says the same thing. He doesn't really change anything, but Matthew embellishes a little bit. He adds some extra stuff there. He has John try to prevent Jesus from being baptized. He says, "Well, I have need to be baptized by you, and you come to me." And so they have a little dialogue there.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that the legendary development that appears to occur, or the theological development that appears to occur between Mark and Luke and Matthew, is not actually evidence in favor of the mythicist hypothesis. It's actually the cornerstone of evidence in favor of the historical Jesus scholarship tradition. The way it counts into the mythicist hypothesis, the historical Jesus tradition holds that there was a guy who then became, who was remembered fondly and became deified in the eyes of his followers over a very short time after his death. The way it plays into the mythicist hypothesis is this. Without something approximating an eyewitness account, there's nothing to tie Jesus to history. The fact that the three Gospels we have which agree, the primary one does not claim to be an eyewitness account. In fact, doesn't make any claims to authorship at all. The account of Luke claims to be a historical document, but not not a critical history, but rather a gathering together of the various traditions to try to come up with the definitive work. So Luke is obviously, and is in fact, states himself, he is not an eyewitness, but he is relying upon the testimony of people he trusts. Right. Matthew makes no claims to eyewitnessship or to witnesshood at all. He doesn't say what he's about other than that he is trying to show that Jesus fulfilled prophecy.
Right. That's really where this goes is, you know, very, very commonly in talking about, you know, historicity, Luke is always held up as this paragon of, you know, he was this great historian and you know, surely it can be admitted that, you know, the guy whoever wrote this, you know, tried to be meticulous about it. But yeah, as you said, he wasn't necessarily critical about it. And analysis of the text shows that he more or less took at least half of Mark and incorporated it directly into his gospel uncritically.
And let's make it clear, this is what good historians do. The fact that Luke was not writing a critical history is not a slur on his character. It's a conclusion based on the evidence within Luke's texts itself. Luke is widely held to be both the author of the Gospel of Luke and of Acts.
Right.
But the two books overlap in the time spans that they cover. And the accounts given of the crucifixion, the resurrection, the post-resurrection appearances, and the ascension in Luke do not match up at all with those in Acts. Now, there's only two ways to deal with this. Either Luke is trying to be a thorough historian and report the various traditions that he considers to be somehow authentic from Jesus, or that are important to the people for whom he's writing, or Luke is engaging in theological development himself and is not terribly tied to the facts. And those aren't mutually exclusive hypotheses, and they're not terribly controversial even among evangelicals who tend towards inerrantism in a doctrinal sense, which is different than the fundamentalist the fundamentalist commitment to inerrancy in a word-for-word sense.
Right, and it's not even something particularly unique, because we can see almost exactly the same type of thing happening in the development of the Pentateuch and the Jewish scriptures.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
With the documentary hypothesis, although that's not really what we're here talking about today. Right. So, okay, well, that lays that out, I think, pretty well. Kevin and John, what are your impressions of this? You know, how do you deal with the synoptic problem? What do you think about it?
Well, certain aspects, I don't think I've studied this to the extent that I can do the quite as good a job as Dan did. But just some cursory readings, like looking at the baptism, some of the differences in some of the alleged, you know, embellishments, say by Matthew, on Jesus' baptism, for example, I'll stick with what we've been doing, don't really have any kind of negative impact. At least this particular instance doesn't, you know, whereas, you know, Matthew saying that John was saying, oh, what, you know, I need to be baptized, but you want to baptize me? What are you talking about? And Jesus is like, no, it must take place for us to fulfill all righteousness, you know? And so something like that to, I guess, separate it from the other accounts and say, well, this part's an embellishment. You know, clearly he just added this on here for some reason. It doesn't seem that it has any particular weight that would contribute to a kind of negative case, really, in terms of, you know, was Matthew being accurate? Was he just kind of going along, or was he trying to add in stuff? But some of the things that are pointed to, such as the baptism, don't really seem to me to have any significant weight in terms of making a case that, you know, Matthew was really trying to do something extra, adding to, you know, a more simplified Jewish peasant version of Jesus, really. It seems maybe he got some different information from another source, but they're, you know, without any real contradiction or something that has some kind of theological significance. Something like that doesn't really bother me, but it is interesting, and I've actually heard like Bob Price and a few others recently say, you know, I'm going to go back over this Q hypothesis stuff, this Q source hypothesis stuff, because, you know, some things aren't quite adding up and some things aren't quite contributing, including some of the different names that are used and the different accounts and the variations on, you know, which women appeared at the tomb.
Yeah.
You know, is that a contradiction? And I'm looking over some stuff right now that's saying, you know, it's not necessarily a contradiction, but tailoring what is being written to a particular audience, because if we're going to refer to a name in a document like this, the person must have been using that name in a particular sense for a particular audience so that they would know what he's talking about. So, for example, if I say, you know, my friend Sasquatch did such and such, you know, Kevin doesn't know who Sasquatch is, but Zach, you do.
Yeah.
And so that would make sense for me to use it for you. But if I'm talking to Kevin and I say, a friend of mine from high school is named Victor Van Kryenberg, he's 6'8", blah, 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 then I'm kind of introducing things. And so some of it seems to be tailoring to a specific audience for a very particular reason. And I think if we read it that way, a lot of these problems make more sense than if we're trying to say, oh, well, look, they all just compiled all this stuff together because they knew it was going to be bunched in a book kind of thing.
Yeah, and that may be the case. I don't know if what we're necessarily saying is that that we're pointing out errors, that we're saying these are mistakes. All that we're really trying to say is that these guys had each other's work in front of them while they were writing their own gospels. And is that, do you think that that is, that adds to their historicity?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I went off in a different direction.
No, that's fine.
Sorry about that. Adds to their historicity. What do you mean by that?
Or detract? Does that make it? I mean, the fact that, for example, Luke, when he was writing his gospel, clearly had, however it worked out, clearly had Mark in front of him or on the table. at the same time that he was writing. Does that, is that...
Well, let me say one thing about it is, I don't think it really takes away from the historicity of it, in that writing was not as well developed. They did have, it was smaller in its sphere, and precisely done. Only very few people, could do it. And rather than today's quest for originality and our very stringent attempts not to, rip other people off, plagiarize, and so on, it seems that earlier histories, they would use each other as templates.
Yeah.
And also have their style in writing in front of them. Like, some mentioned that Paul tends to kind of follow some things that are similar in Herodotus and some things like that. So maybe these guys had a style in mind. And, I don't think originality was necessarily, what they were going for there. F.F. Bruce does talk about the Gospels, including the Synoptics, despite the Synoptic problem, they have some differing emphasis going on. And it might be a topic from another time, but I am interested in the embellishment problem, whether it would be, I call it the embellishment problem, whether it would be embellishment, whether it would be theological development, higher Christology, which you're going to find in John, than you're going to find in Mark.
Yeah.
And so on. Does that lend more toward historicity or ahistoricity, or would it lend more toward mythicism? And
or
and
it
so
could
on?
Be just, or could be neutral. Could be either.
Yeah,
way.
Yeah, it could be neutral. If anything, if there was embellishment that was not historical, it is going to really weaken some versions of inerrancy. But I don't think it's going to weaken historicity. And I give you an interesting example of this, something I'm looking into further. Matthew 27, people look at the resurrected saints there in Matthew 27.
When, oh, yeah.
Graves are split open, and we have a lot of things going on. And a few of the followers of Jesus, or the saints, literally resurrected at the time of Christ's resurrection and appeared to some people, and so on. And apparently this was a revivification similar to what Jesus did earlier in Lazarus and so on, and not a resurrection body like Jesus received, the immortal body and so forth, the resurrected body, but merely a revivification of people who died again. And it was either an historical event in keeping with the profoundly strange things that were going on because of the incarnation and the resurrection, and what was going on there, and many theologians see it as kind of a first fruits of Christ from the dead, indicative of Christ's power over death and everything, and some things like this that happened. It's only mentioned in Matthew, and then there are even some conservative scholars who hold that that's not historical, but it is apocalyptic language that Matthew is using to emphasize the profundity of the event. And he's using this common apocalyptic language to try to heighten or advance the event. I take the more conservative view on that, but I really don't have much of a problem with the other.
Yeah.
In that there's at least some solid theological reasons for why something rather strange like that would happen.
It's because of Matthew's reliance on the Psalms to do his whole passion narrative. I think it's quite clear that whether there was a Jesus or not, that's a theological motif going on there rather than history.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But now the disagreement between the Gospels is not the thing that. Is not the thing that calls historicity into question, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
The, in fact, it's actually quite the opposite. It's the similarities that raise questions for me. Not the fact that they have similarities in narrative, but the fact that Luke and Matthew rely on a single text, and they quote it closely enough that it's obvious that it was in front of them. It militates against either of them being eyewitnesses or having direct verbal access to eyewitnesses. And Mark makes no claims about being an eyewitness. It's tradition that Mark was reporting, was Peter's secretary and reporting on Peter. Doesn't come till late in the second century, the writings of Irenaeus, which describe the Gospel of Mark in such a way that the description actually matches an apocalyptic book called The Preaching of Peter, far better than it matches the Gospel of Mark. And that's where the synoptic problem militates against historicity, at least from my perspective.
Yeah. Well, okay, so now we've discussed the synoptic problem and, you know, the sort of the concept that at least, you know, as the mythicist lays on the table that, you know, these men, whoever wrote the Gospels, may not have been writing history, at least not history as we would consider history. And so I want to just sort of take a closer look and look at a couple details of their accounts. To see if, you know, if what they actually say that we're taking as history, if that actually correlates with what we know about established historical facts. And there's a number of these that you can pick up with, in the Gospels that are really better suited for, sort of debunking claims of inerrancy. That's really what they're better suited. But I do want to just sort of mention that they're out there, and one of them, a real simple one, is, this one gets a lot of play, is, you know, the time of the census that's mentioned at Jesus' birth. It's supposed to have occurred during the reign of Herod and the governorship of Quirinius, but these two reigns didn't overlap. So this would be, you know, this would be something that would not be it would not be possible given what we know about the historical situation at the time when these guys actually reigned. And so the fact that seems to be a mistake lessens the quality of the historical scholarship of these works. Another sort of subtle point about this is regarding the census anyway, is the fact that it's depicted as having the inhabitants of Palestine having to return to their ancestral town, and this really does not make any sense. For a census, because you don't really want to know where the people came from. You want to know where they are right now. So you know where the tax revenues are going to come from. And in fact, I don't think we have any record of any census occurring throughout history that makes you, you know, like I'm from Cincinnati, and you know, when the census comes up, I don't have to go back to Cincinnati to register for that. You know, it doesn't make any sense, you know, just sort of thinking about that.
And adding to that, although it's very clear that Luke is attempting to tie Jesus to history there, Luke is the only one of all four gospel writers that has Jesus being born in Bethlehem. Mark and John don't contain accounts of the nativity at all, and Matthew's account of the nativity is brief and seems to have Jesus being born in Nazareth before fleeing down through Bethlehem to Egypt.
Right, and going to Bethlehem seems to, in Luke anyway, to have a theological motivation, because he wants to sort of emphasize his ties to the Davidic line.
Yes.
And so, you know, if that, you know, by bringing this up is not to take shots at Luke, but just to say that, you know, if in the way he was constructing his account, he was motivated primarily by theological reasons and less by historical reasons per se.
There's an implicit slur in there about Luke's motivations and character, and I don't think that's probably justified. I think if we're looking at anything here, we're looking at the age-old problem of selection bias on the part of a historian. The historian going to construct an account is going to be naturally disposed to believe the accounts that accord with what he already understands more than he's going to believe accounts that don't. And that's a very natural human thing. It doesn't require self-conscious fraud. It doesn't require deceit. It's just the way human beings are wired. So I don't think we need to even go into the notion that Luke is doing this primarily for theological reasons. I think Luke believed that Jesus was of the line of David, and this account firmly tied him to it, and this is the account that Luke already believes, so this is the one he used.
Right, but it's not a critical process, and not to imply that he was, you know, just not that he was dumb or not that he was conspiratorial in some way, just that, you know, he had, in addition to whatever historical motivations he had very specific theological motivations that colored, yeah,
which he states outright in the prologue of his book.
Right.
You know, I think that Zach made a good point in that, if anything, and I would concur with this, if anything, if there are historical mistakes, errors, or whatever, that is going to damage many versions of inerrancy and some things like that, and not necessarily historicity. And, you know, for famous inerrantists out there, there are some answers to the census problem and some things like that. And I tell you, though, I used to have my little pat answers to that, but I'm not so I think more research has been done that made some of my little pat answers not quite as, you know, quite so pat. And so I think more work needs to be done on that. Another mistake that people often make is to think that Matthew is actually trying to show prophecy fulfilled, when in essence he's not. When he's referring to Egypt and he's referring to some other aspects there, he's only trying to show typology, a typological reference in reverence for the scriptures and so on, and not necessarily a hardcore messianic prophecy. You know, like the Egyptian prophecy is not a messianic prophecy. It's only a typological prophecy that Matthew sees there. And there's a couple like that early in Matthew. We do have an edict in AD 104, C. Vibius Maximus. He was the Roman prefect of Egypt. And he did send out a notice that says, quote, "The enrollment by household being at hand, it is necessary to notify all who, for any cause whatsoever, are away from their administrative divisions to return home in order to comply with the customary ordinance of enrollment and to remain in their own agricultural land." And so, we have some enrollment.
Calling serfs to return from where they're at.
Yeah. And so we got a couple of inscriptional evidence that talks about these poor people having to go back, and, you know, and they couldn't take the bus. I mean, it was a brutal, to get somewhere, but they literally made them go back and enroll, and they got the data on them, stuff like that, and then they wanted them back in their agricultural land and things like that. And so it's weird, but it's not far fetched.
But there's also the problem that at the time of the alleged census, Judea wasn't under Roman rule, which is a bigger problem. And of course, by the time the Gospels were written, even if you use conservative dating, Judea was under Roman rule. But at the time the census is supposed to have taken place, it wasn't. And so that's a forgivable mistake, but it does remove the account one step further from history.
Right. Well, and you know, of course, all these mistakes aside, you know, there are a number of places where, you know, you can quibble about these details and, you know, argue that this is contradicts history or not. But it really does seem to be more of a thing against inerrancy than historicity per se, because, you know, mistakes could be made with a historical Jesus. I mean, you could have a mistake made
the problem that presents for historicity is not the same as the problem it presents for inerrancy. The problem it presents for historicity is that at every verifiable place, every place we can test with what survives, where the Gospels are tied to history, which are namely really only two. There are two, perhaps four, depending on how you count. The two that you can certainly tie the Gospels to history if they stood up to that test are at the census, where they don't, and at the at the trial of Jesus,
yeah.
which doesn't jive with how we know the Roman legal system and the Jewish legal system worked in concert at the time. The two other places you could potentially tie Jesus to history are the storming of the temple, the ejection of the moneylenders.
Right.
The account there is very clearly not written by someone who had ever been to the temple, because
right.
the temple itself is incredibly huge.
Much too large.
It would have taken, and did take, the several times it was recorded, a small army to eject the moneylenders. That's a military operation. Couldn't have happened with one person, and if it did, it would have been recorded, and there wouldn't have been any quibbling over whether Jesus was a criminal or not. I just lost the other point at which it's potentially tieable to history, but those are the three big ones.
Well, I want to bring up, aside from these, you know, contradictions per se, aside from these, I want to bring up something that, is just on the face of it, doesn't really make, you know, not quibbling over whether or not it actually happened, but just in what is actually being reported, one has to wonder if this reflects an historical interpretation or not. And I'm talking about the letter of Claudius Lysias in Acts 22, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with this. I was not very much. It was brought up. It was brought to my attention by Richard Carrier, who talks about it at length, and it's actually very interesting. In Acts 22, of course, Paul has upset the local Jews, and they want to have him killed. And the Roman authorities get involved, and the guy who's in charge is Claudius Lysias, and he, you know, he finds out that Paul is a Roman citizen, and, you know, is not quite sure what to do, so he sends him along to the governor with this letter, and the letter is actually reproduced in Acts, and it says, I, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man, Paul, was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over a question about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. Now, there's no dispute over whether or not this is historical. Now, in fact, it may be, you know, if Paul is historical and most people think he was, it may actually be a historical remnant or in some part a historical remnant. But what is said here seems very, very strange. If you are approaching this from a historical perspective, because what this Roman guy, Claudius Lysias, what he is aware of Paul to have done is just to transgress some aspect of Jewish law, something that he wasn't concerned about, something he didn't care about. Now, if you remember back when we were talking in the Arguments of Silence, we were talking about Pliny the Younger, when he first encountered Christianity. And his response on learning what Christianity taught and what the adherents believed was to execute them, you know, put them to death. And the reason for that was because they declared their fealty to this man, Jesus, who was a god. And, of course, that flew right in the face of the Roman, you know, emperor cult. You could not venerate anybody else as a god except for the emperor.
No. You couldn't venerate anyone else as God and king. They had plenty of gods.
Oh, okay, and king. Right. So this is very, very – the response of Claudius Lysias to Paul is very, very different from the response of Pliny the Younger to the Christians that he encountered in Bithynia. What was his province?
It was in Asia.
Galatia.
Yeah.
And so what this implies then is that whatever was communicated to Claudius Lysias about Paul's beliefs was very, very different from the beliefs that were communicated to Pliny the Younger about the Christians in his province, which of course happened, you know, half a century later. And at the very least, we should be able to conclude from this that what Paul did not believe in a man who was king and God at the same time, that would in any way threaten his life at the hands of the Romans, or at least not immediately. You know,
that's overstating the case a bit.
Is that overstating? Why don't you say it?
I think we can comfortably conclude from that case that whatever it was that Paul preached, the one thing he did not preach was that Jesus was the return of the Davidic kingship.
Okay. Which is very...
I think going any farther with that is illegitimate.
Okay. But
is that online, Zach? Zach, is that online from Carrier? I do want to check that out.
I don't know if he's written about it, but I've heard him speak about it several times.
He's got a... He's got a lot on the Quirinius census problem as well, mm-hmm. and I keep promising myself I'm going to go over that because a lot of people refer to it. But those are two things from Carrier that sound worth checking out.
Right, but at any rate, whatever this says, this does not. Whatever Paul is preaching or is claiming to believe, it does not seem to be the historical Jesus as communicated in the Gospels. There seems to be a disconnect there. And if, for example, if the mythicist position is accurate, and if Paul was just, if he had a conception of some other mythical deity, like Tammuz or whomever, then, you know, that was a reinterpretation of some, you know, Jewish scripture, whatever. You know, that's basically what Claudius Lysias is saying, that there's some contention over some matter of Jewish law, and nothing that the Romans need to get concerned about. So,
interesting.
Have I left anything out of that, Dan? Aside from overstating,
I think the one thing we haven't hit on yet is the question of whether Mark was writing history, which is too big to go into thoroughly here, but is worth mentioning. The tradition, the assumption which has classically tied Jesus to history is that at least some of the Gospels, if not all of them, and depending on which denomination you're from and which biblical studies paradigm you're from, it goes anywhere from one of them to all of them, or to none of them, were an eyewitness. Orthodox believers, Orthodox theologians have always believed that the gospel tradition rested in some way on eyewitness testimony. The fact that, and by the way, this is why John A.T. Robinson advocated Johannine priority, because he recognized that the synoptic problem militated against any, except perhaps Mark, being eyewitness testimony. But John doesn't claim to depend on earlier written accounts. And so he argued that John must be the one eyewitness testimony we've got for sure. Now, the tradition that holds John as an eyewitness testimony comes from the last chapter of John, and from the use of the motif of the beloved disciple, which seems to be in light of the last chapter, which says, "I, John, saw these things with my own eyes." I don't have it in front of me, but it directly claims an eyewitness authorship. And the use of the motif of the beloved disciple throughout it, reading backwards from that point, seems to be the author claiming his own presence in the story and that he was the beloved disciple. Unfortunately, the last three chapters of John are seriously contested as being original on textual critical grounds and on higher critical grounds. The chapter claiming authorship doesn't match the vocabulary, the style, or any of the other hallmarks of the writing style of the rest of the book in Greek. And it doesn't appear in our earliest manuscripts, kind of like the long end of the park.
Right.
The second to the last set of events includes the miraculous catch of fish, which we covered earlier, which is quite directly borrowed from Pythagoreanism.
Yeah, Pythagorean.
Perhaps it doesn't sink John's historicity, but does cast into significant doubt where John was getting his source material from, because the the only direct claim in all four of the Gospels we have to eyewitnessship is shown to be a later interpolation. And so the last question then is, did Mark believe he was writing history, and where did he get it from? And that's a question, like I said, it's way esoteric.
Right. And of course we've talked a little bit about how it's possible that he may have been, you know, sort of rewriting the Odyssey from a Christian perspective, and maybe, you know, if that was true, then definitely he wasn't writing history. He was sort of rewriting.
Well, no, that's not true, because Matthew also was writing Mimesis of a different sort. He was writing Jewish Midrash. As Kevin said, he's recasting what he believed were events into a typology that would communicate to his audience. But so the fact that Mark seems to be doing the same kind of thing with Homer, particularly considering how people were taught to read at the time, doesn't mean that Mark wasn't writing history. But it does show that he, whatever else he was doing, he was writing literature. The echoes and the theological construction of Mark further shows it to be primarily a theological document. There are several typical narrative motifs. Carrier goes into this at great length in one of his papers.
Hey guys, I'm sorry to have to bug out, but I've got the two kids here and they're done with the thing, and I got a bolt.
Okay.
And I don't want to drive and talk at the same time.
Yeah.
I'll run straight in the ditch.
Okay.
Good stuff. Count me in on the next one. And John, just say whatever I'm going to say, all right?
Okay.
whatever I would say, you say it, all right?
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Talk to you later, Kevin.
All right. We'll see you guys. Bye.
But because of all these things, and because there's no explicit claim to history, and because the points at which it intersects with recorded history in Mark, which is primarily at the trial, don't match up with how we know the society to have functioned, it removes the supporting evidence for Mark being historical. Doesn't mean Mark didn't think he was writing history, but it does mean there's no way we can test that what he's saying was history.
Right.
And it's that plus the prevalence of mythic and extraordinary motifs and legendary embellishment that leads me, at least, to the tentative conclusion that even though Luke obviously believed he was writing history, and Matthew might have, I don't think Mark was. And even if he was, I don't think we have a good reason to believe that the reportage is reliable.
And that's a good segue into textual criticism, which we'll get into in just a couple of minutes. But first, I want to get John's take on all the stuff that we've been covering over the past several minutes.
Well, some of it, I guess I will be answering a little bit like Kevin. Some of it I haven't looked into, and I'm going to have to get my hands on some Carrier, who I really like, by the way. I've listened to a few interviews and podcasts and stuff with him. I think he makes some good points, and I'm going to have to look at that. But one thing, sometimes I notice on some of the talk that goes on with at least a few of these issues, obviously I'm not going to do anything blanket here, but sometimes folks will refer to like the census, or I know Bob Price talks about the Passover and the fact that these Jewish authorities are not going to take time away from the Passover, given its importance, to actually be like, what, someone's claiming to be God? Okay, well, let's stop all this and forget the Passover. We're going to go execute this guy. You know, he said that doesn't make sense. Customarily, it doesn't make sense for them to do that. They wouldn't do that. The Passover feast is way more important. And it's not like Jesus was the first person claiming to be God or anything like that. Why would they do this? I think to be very careful with things like, why would this happen? Or saying, this wouldn't normally take place, or this seems odd historically. And I don't, by the way, like I said, I'm not going to do anything blanket here and say that the instances where there's something seriously jacked up, or it's like, hey, where the heck, I mean, this would not happen, or, you know, we know for a fact this happened in history, but the gospel said this happened instead. I'm not talking about those instances, but at least in the instances where someone might be tempted to say, well, that seems odd. That's kind of weird. That doesn't normally happen. You know, speaking from particular presuppositions, God doesn't really normally come down from heaven either. And I know I'm kind of, you know, playing up inspiration here, but it would seem to me reasonable to say, okay, even though that's odd, it's not as if we can separate the oddity of that occurrence from what else is going on. So it's not like we can say, okay, well, so Jesus is here, but let's put that aside for a minute and just look at this. I think that there's a mistake going on, and it seems that there'd be some kind of fallacy there in separating things like that simply to attack another aspect. A, because it's not presented that way in the gospel narratives or elsewhere, and B, it doesn't take everything into account. And so now I know that we would have to assume a lot on the other side and say, okay, well, if we're not going to talk that way, then we are saying Jesus did this, Jesus did this, Jesus did this. But I think that those things have to at least be taken into consideration in terms of examining the documents themselves. Otherwise, you know, we're trying to make something that happened in history fit what ought to be the case, not given the fact that, you know, God came down from heaven. And I think, for example, this will be real quick with Pharaoh. I think there's an interesting point to look at concerning what happened with Pharaoh in Exodus, where God told Pharaoh, I raised you up for this purpose so that my power would be displayed through you. Now, looking from a historical perspective, trying to take God out of the equation and say, okay, well, you know, Pharaoh wouldn't normally do this. Pharaoh wouldn't really, you know, refuse to let these people go seven times, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Pharaoh wouldn't really blah, blah, blah. But out of God's own mouth, well, I think anyway, God says, I raised you up. I ordained this would happen. However weird it is, it's kind of why it's being written about. And it's exactly why I think the Gospels were being written, because they're like, hey, this is really weird. I'm going to write this down because this is kind of strange. And if God indeed did ordain that the punishment and death of Jesus were to take place for reasons of justification, then we could say, okay, well, in that light, it does make sense for some things to kind of be out of place if God is ordaining this particular event.
Yeah, and you know, that's theologically, that's entirely accurate. But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but since we're arguing sort of historically, yes, we're not saying that something is impossible. It's entirely possible that there could be a Jesus, but the historical evidence and the way you have to approach these things historically, I think, makes it more likely that that is not the case. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Dan.
Yeah, I'd go into a little more depth on that if I can. What you're positing, John, is if you assume from the beginning that God is active in history and that he was particularly active at this point in history, is not an unreasonable way of arguing based on that assumption. But when it comes to interrogating the document as historical records, it's a problem, because having no analogous examples in the whole of the rest of world history for people behaving in ways that are contrary to their interest, their character, and what they were known to have been like, you have to raise a red flag on that, because we do see that kind of thing happening in political screes of one nation against another, you know, like the blood libel against the Jews, saying the Jews were using children as human sacrifices to conduct obscene versions of the mass to offend God and that kind of thing, under demonic influence. Of course, if the demonic world exists, it's possible that that was going on. But we have no other reason to think so besides the fact that someone with a particular theological agenda said so. So the argument against historicity isn't because God didn't exist, this couldn't happen argument. It's a because the rest of history operates in a particular way, and the rest of this time period and the other records of these people, particularly Herod and the Sanhedrin and Pilate, portray them as like this. Here we have an account that is fully out of character for all of these people. And that portrays events, and I'm not talking about the miracles here. You know, if God exists, miracles are possible. I got no problem with that. Even if God doesn't exist, miracles still may be possible. I've got no problem with that either. But have portrayals of known people acting in ways that are totally contrary to what both their friends and their enemies say about them in the surviving records. And that, to my mind, that takes it outside the realm of history, even if it happened, because history has no way to verify them or even to confirm them as plausible. By every canon of history, it comes off as rather fantastic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I guess I was using the idea that the idea of God intervening not so much to really be the absolute ground for the point that I was trying to make. The point I was trying to make was, you know, yeah, this is, you know, just for things that are odd or seem kind of strange, or, you know, this doesn't normally seem like things would go this way kind of thing. It's one of those instances where, well, we're not really talking about something normal anyway. I mean, even if Jesus...
You're kind of arguing that way, like, for the benefit of the doubt, right?
Yeah, and, something, I guess, kind of like that. And obviously, I'll be honest here, ultimately, it does lead to, look, I really think God structured this way.
Yeah.
But I am, what I'm trying to do is, instead of saying this raises a red flag, figures of speech aside, to me, even trying to look at this historically, it raises more of a dark yellow flag, okay. Where it's kind of like, you know, like, this is really strange and it's kind of weird, but it doesn't do away with all of this kind of thing. And I'm not saying that's what y'all are trying to do, but in terms of building the case, obviously it only adds to the picture. But I think I guess I don't think it lends weight to a red flag as much as, you know, it's just a yellow flag.
You know, forgive me for making this observation, but I can't help but wonder if you're so, if this might just be like an unlooked for victory for skepticism and empiricism, that, you know, the concept of historicity is so much tied up in the concept of truth that if it's not historical, it can't be true. Whereas, you know, if you're approaching this from a religious perspective, just because something is not necessarily historical doesn't mean it can't be true. I mean, you know, just to this is kind of off the side, but I mean, look at the Mormons. You know, I mean, they've had so much of the historical evidence and the empirical evidence. You know, that they argue that the Native Americans, the Aboriginal Americans, are descended from ancestral Hebrews, and we've done DNA testing and show that no, that's not the case. They're actually Asian, and that. It completely shows that what the Book of Mormon shows them is not historical, but they don't really have a problem believing it. And maybe, I mean, not that I'm advocating that, well, you know, go ahead and believe in something even if it's not historical, but I just think it's, I don't know, this is just an observation of mine that, you're kind of not stuck in that mindset, but you're sort of fighting for the same mindset that Dan and I are fighting for, that if, you know, something to be true, it should be, you know, it's best that it's verified by historical methods. right? Is that kind of what you're...
I'll be honest. I mean, let's say they dig up Jesus or something, you know, or, you know, it turns out, oh, no, we found the guy that did it. He wrote all this stuff. And, you know, I have no clue. But, I mean, something that's knocked down, drag out, like, look, man, this is totally bunk here. You know, I'm not going to be like, no, it's true in my heart. You know, I'm not going to just be like, but, it's true. But,
I mean, but there are Christians that will, you know, like I talked with William Lane Craig, and he basically said that very same thing, that, you know, that there's essentially no empirical evidence that you could put in front of him that would contradict his own personal experience of Jesus. And not to say that that's what you should do. I mean, obviously, I don't think that, but it is possible to do that. And I just think it's you know, I don't know. The fact that so many Christians do feel like they have to grapple with historicity.
Well, I think there's
maybe this is for a later time. I think this is for a later discussion. But
well, there's a very particular reason that Christians have to grapple with historicity. It's that unique among the world's monotheistic religions, Christianity depends upon a historical reality, mm-hmm. at least as formulated through the Nicene Creed. It is a explicitly historical faith.
Right.
And if the events that it depends on are not historical, it calls the paradigm of salvation into question. And that's a very important thing. Kudos to Christianity for having the guts to make those claims. There's an amount of daring there that shouldn't be overlooked. It's very cool. I had something else, but I lost it.
Yeah, I really don't want to come across that way. And what I think a responsible Christian has to do is take these things into consideration. But just like anyone else, everything has to be taken into consideration to a certain extent.
Yeah,
I think some folks will look at something like Q and think, wow, well, if Matthew and Luke copied, then obviously they weren't inspired. Obviously they had no idea what they're talking about. And I'm not a Christian. I mean, you know, we hear things like this sometimes.
That's kind of an elementary chain of reasoning there. It's not very nuanced.
Yeah. And so just as a chain of reasoning must be nuanced, and it must be seasoned and developed. A lot of history is being developed and things like that. Now, I'm not going to put all this off and say, well, look, history will eventually vindicate us. What I'm saying is, okay, there are some problems here, and I'll take a look at those. And I know some folks who, you know, will look at the end of, is it Mark's gospel? I forget. And say, okay, look, I don't accept that. I don't think that's scripture. It was that the textual evidence is way too late for that. I don't accept it. And they're able to make moves like that based on a given amount of evidence. Now, I think a responsible person...
And even conservative textual critics have no problem with that being a later addition. The understanding that both conservative and liberal textual critics have of the way that redaction works is that after a certain point, you've got something that people are considering holy writ in whatever way they consider that. So you may have additions in marginal notes to explain that accidentally get incorporated in. You may have direct additions to help clarify things that are doctrinally ambiguous during a crisis. But you won't have people feeling like they have the freedom to delete things that are there. Because they don't want to be deleting the words of God. They don't mind explaining them. They don't mind interpreting them, but they don't want to be treading on God's territory by excising things that are already there.
Right. And this, you know, this is actually, we'll leave that discussion for later. That's a tantalizing, sample of what's to come. That's a perfect segue. Let's move right into the textual criticism stuff, because you were just getting into that.
All right. Let me wrap up the ahistoricity part,
okay.
If I could. At least we talked about the arguments from silence and the arguments from mythic similarities and typological similarities being interesting but not compelling, but we set the ahistoricity thing up as being the thing that both of us found kind of the clincher for the case. The reason I find it the clincher is not because, it's because the ahistoricity case has two edges on it, either one of which on their own would not be enough for me to say, okay, this didn't happen. There is the mistakes, say the errors in tying Jesus to history that, you know, around Jewish legal proceedings and Roman legal proceedings and the date of the census and all that stuff that are easily explained by the fact that the gospel writers were writing later and not in Israel, right? Not a problem. People get things mixed up. There's the other side of the equation where you have the events that are tieable to history, like the storming of the temple or the resurrection of the saints, which, again, those are big, big events that we would expect secular historians to record, and they don't. Now, it's conceivable that a secular historian, particularly if this was happening in Egypt, which was known to rewrite its history in favor of the current monarch, in a way that Rome didn't. But we could conceivably grant that that would happen, you know, that these radical events were a threat to somebody, and so they just expunged them from the record, or so they expunged them from the record. But it's not reasonable to say no one noticed, because these were big deals. And Josephus certainly noticed a whole bunch of smaller deals of the same sort of character. So either one of those by themselves, you could kind of slide off and chalk up to politics or distance. But when you have every event in the Gospels that ties Jesus to history being either unverifiable, because they're unverified because no secular or other historian reports them, or you have them being mired in so much error you can't quite tell what the writers thought was going on, you then don't have any historical pins upon which to rest Jesus. And that's the sum total of my argument from ahistoricity and why I find it compelling.
Hmm. All right. Well, you touched on the textual critical aspects of this too. I mean, aside from on their face value, I mean, if you assume that the scriptures are untouched from the time that they were written to the time that we read them now, you know, there are, like you just mentioned, there are some pretty serious things to contend with. We also have to sort of grapple with the fact that it's entirely plausible that there was revision and redaction that took place in the scriptures, especially as orthodoxy arose within Christianity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is contained within some books by Bart Ehrman, The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture, and also he has a more popular interpretation of that or version of that called Misquoting Jesus. Yeah. And he talks about, he's got a copy of a page from Codex Vaticanus, which is the opening of the letter to the Hebrews, mm-hmm. Which contains a phrase, Jesus bears all things by the words of his power, which has been rewritten in several versions. The word bears, anyway, the bears has been replaced with manifests, which has a slightly different meaning. Actually a significantly different meaning. And the one possible reason for this may be that the Greek words for these are very, very similar. There's pharaon and phaneron. So, you know, a very minor change in these, well, you know, changes in the way it's written anyway, changes the meaning of the word greatly. And he has a framed copy of this page in his office where one of the scribes who was copying it wrote in the margins of the manuscript, "Fool and knave, leave the old reading, don't change it." You know, so at any rate, it's entirely plausible, and we know that it's highly probable that as these scriptures were copied, that there were changes introduced in the manuscript. And a lot of these...
Let's go a step further, because it's not contested. Conservative Orthodox Bible textual scholars and liberal textual scholars both agree redaction happened. It's not if it happened, it's that it did. The argument is over whether the redaction amounts to something that is doctrinally important.
Right.
Liberals make the case that our oldest manuscript traditions don't go back far enough to give us surety that that doctrinal changes and arguments weren't introduced into the text early on by competing factions.
Right.
Conservative scholars counter that by saying, look, we have so many copies that we can arrive at a certain early date of things, and then we can be confident because there's so much redundancy in the New Testament that even if a doctrinal point is changed here or changed there, no one could have changed all of them. So our original doctrine still survives even through the corruption process, and that's God's way of providentially ensuring the transmission of Scripture.
Right. And this is, we know this is plausible, entirely plausible. I mean, it's like you said, it's pretty much accepted.
We know what happened. It's not plausible. Yeah. We know what happened.
And it happened at a very early time. We know Celsus, this is one of his common accusations. You know, he said that, well, you know, you Christians, you're constantly changing the text of your scriptures to suit your theological needs. And Irenaeus accused Marcion of the same thing. You know, he said that he was changing the letters of Paul to support his Gnosticism. You know, so this is not out of a clear blue sky. This is something that, you know, if somebody wanted, you know, in the ancient, you know, first, second century, if somebody wanted to advocate a certain theological position, what they would do is change the text of the scriptures. We know that they were not afraid to do it. It happened a lot. And it's entirely plausible. And in fact, there are, you know, we've mentioned some of these already, just in the discussion. We know that, of course, the ending to Mark was added much after the fact. The original ending of Mark ended with the empty tomb and the women running away scared. And there's this whole section there, verses 9 through 20 of chapter 16, that was added much later. And yet it's still in people's Bibles. You know, I mean, people still regard it as scripture. There's a passage in there that refers to, you know, Christians were able to pick up serpents and drink poison. And so, and we have people in America,
we have entire denominations
who handle, you know, these snake handling churches in the foothills of the, you know, the Appalachians that do this because, you know, they accept this as scripture. And there's other things too. In John, you know, the part about the woman caught in adultery, she's brought before Jesus, and he says, you know, he who is without sin cast the first stone. That's a great story, but it's not authentic. It was added much later, and a lot of people use that in sermons, and they do because it's a great story, but it's not scripture.
Right. The essential question eventually, when it comes to textual criticism, the essential question eventually comes down to epistemology and standards of truth. The Orthodox scholars, have what they call a presumption of innocence with regards to the text. And we presume that these are saying what they're saying and that they're essentially reliable, except when we find places where they're not. And the skeptical biblical scholars say, wait a minute, that's not legitimate. We have a text that has been changed in so many ways and was under the rubric of a political organization for so long that, when it fails, to be consistent on so many points, we can't then assume that on the points we like, it is consistent. And this is essentially what the debate over whether textual criticism is theologically significant comes down to.
What's your take on it, John?
I actually really like getting into the textual criticism. I've got a couple of Metzger materials here. One's called The Text of the New Testament, Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration. And it's got one here called A Textual Commentary on the Greek New Testament, which I have open in front of me.
And for those listeners who don't know, Metzger is one of the primary people responsible for the textual critical edition of the New Testament that most Bibles are based on now.
Yeah, Ehrman's a disciple of his, isn't he?
Yep. Ehrman was one of his students, and Ehrman's arch nemesis, Dan Wallace at Dallas Theological Seminary, is also one of his colleagues.
Interesting.
Oh, I wonder if I'll study under him.
Oh yeah. Hey, if you ever meet Dan, he is a great guy. He and my father went to seminary together, so I grew up knowing him tangentially.
Very cool.
Lots of fun. He'll take you out for a beer and a cigar and argue with you all night.
Excellent. Yeah, I like a lot of this stuff because I learned going back to a book by Gary Friesen or Friesen. I'm not sure how you say his name.
Yeah, Friesen.
It is Friesen. Okay. A book called Decision Making in the Will of God absolutely revolutionized my walk with Christ because I had realized how much I was adding to scripture, things that are read in, and there are only two passages, for example, with the phrase led by the Spirit. And, but you hear people constantly, I'm led to give you this verse. I feel led to play this song. I feel led to do this. I feel led to wear this pair of shorts. I mean, it's almost ridiculous sometimes.
Buddha Christianity.
So when I realized, man, where did that even come from? People just like read this in there. And then, so I was like, okay, well, I need to sharpen my exegesis. And I started doing that and realizing that there are other things too that we read in, and some things obvious, some things not so obvious. And
some things that you read out because they just don't seem to work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so that primed me for a lot of this. And, when I saw on the cover of this Metzger book, the text of the New Testament, its transmission, corruption, and restoration. It was still kind of early on, and that kind of shook me a little bit. So like, what does he mean, corruption? And then, I mean, if you read this thing, Metzger is ridiculously candid. Oh yeah, there's this error and there's this problem and somebody added this in. Isn't that funny? And it kind of freaked me out a little bit, but then I got really excited. Let's dig into this and let's not be afraid here, because if the ultimate goal is getting at what we believe God had to say here through this text, then our biases and commitments, theological and otherwise, have to be put aside, and we have to be able to say, okay, look, let's look at this. You know, the ending of Mark, it's just not there. There's not support. There's not evidence. Maybe we should just let's do away with this so we can be careful.
And, so is that what you do? Because I'm wondering, what do you do then with the end of Mark? Do you take a black Sharpie and black it out in your Bible? Or?
I haven't gone that far, actually, because, and I know this, I annoy a lot of my brothers this way. And a lot of my
like brethren rather than your biological siblings,
brethren.
Right?
I don't have any biological brothers. I'm sorry. There's no way you would know that. But yes, my Christian brethren and some of my philosophical, I guess, brethren. Why not this way? Because there are some things where I won't make an absolute stake, like the ending of Mark, to say, you know, I've looked at it a little bit. But I'm not going to say, okay, well, Greg Kokel says he doesn't accept it, so I'm not either. Or, you know, so-and-so says this, so, you know what, they're trustworthy. I won't go that route. So, no, I have not yet taken a black Sharpie to my NASB and blacked out the end of Mark. What I try to do instead is read it and see, you know, what do I do with this? And I just kind of go along that way. And that's really all I can do at this point. But as far as the redaction and these kinds of things go, some of it doesn't surprise me. In some ways, it's like, okay, well, that's to be expected. People are going to do that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And some of it's really understandable when you look at it, especially from the perspective of looking at other verses that don't have things in there where you say, you know what? If so-and-so, you know, if whatever scribe would have stuck this in here, this would have really pulled this together a lot more nicely and made a lot more sense. And so some of it, I think both of those concepts, the idea of people simplifying something by adding something in there to make it more simple, and the other case of not adding something, I think those two concepts can play off of each other a little bit and say, okay, well, if they did it here, why on earth wouldn't someone have done it, you know, here in Romans, you know, or like Hebrews 6? Mm-hmm. It's like, man, this really could use some clarification. Why not? And so seeing those instances where things could have really been cleared up gives me pause to where I'm not so reactive in those instances where someone may have added something, because of, you know, maybe this person, was in contact with an eyewitness and they said, you know, well, here's this, you know, here's what I'm telling you. Person writes it down. And to them, if you're hearing something from a source, it makes sense while you're hearing it, kind of like taking notes in class. The prof says something, you write it down. Oh, that makes perfect sense. You look at it later. What the hell did I just write? You know, and that kind of thing. So I think there are instances where maybe another scribe thought, you know, this would make more sense. I'll bet that's what he was saying. I'm going to go ahead and put this in there kind of thing. So, but,
And people, listeners, particularly Christian listeners, who are interested in getting a good grasp on the discipline of textual criticism and don't want to quite yet jump down the road of all us infidels and wading hip deep through skeptical literature, the place to start is with a good textual critical translation of the Bible. And there are two or three that are out there. One is the NASB, the other is the New English Translation, and these are books that they're prepared by believers, but they're prepared by believers who want to be open about the textual history in order to make sure everything is above board. And they will list out in the footnotes, if you get a good scholarly edition, the variant readings, or places where they don't know what the word was, so they took something they thought might be similar or might communicate it, but they're not sure. You know, a good textual critical edition of the Bible will list these things out. And that's a good place to start.
Okay.
Excellent. Great recommendation.
All right. Well, John, I think you've got to take off, actually.
Yeah. I don't want to seem rude by asking this at all. So if it sounds rude, please, I'm not trying to be rude. Were we going to get to number four fairly quickly, because I can kind of say a little something before I duck out. Or?
Why don't we get on that one? What was number four?
I'm not in front of the
Number four is the argument that Carrier gives in The Empty Tomb about Paul conceiving of Jesus not as a historical being, but as if he was a historical being, was not raised as a fleshly, you know, all that stuff. So do you have something to say for that one, John, before you leave?
Yeah, I did. Some of what Paul says in his epistles, I think, wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense unless Paul thought of Jesus as at least a fleshly being. And what I really did was I poured through my Greek New Testament, and I looked at all the instances of the word sarx, in Greek, is flesh, and other variations of the word flesh. Now, Paul uses it, and I'm not going to spout on all the references. That would just be annoying. But I can email them to you. Paul uses them. Paul and others, Luke and John both use them. Peter, the writer of Hebrews, Matthew use this word, and it's really limited in its scope and must refer to flesh. Other uses are the body, human frame, lineage, humanity, circumstances of the body, carnality, materiality, and those sorts of things. And so I think, where I'm going with this, I think Paul is a pretty creative guy. He's really intelligent. There are some instances where he kind of puts words together to create new ideas and concepts. Now, for something as significant as the person, only merely spiritual or otherwise, the person of Jesus, Paul would have something different for Jesus. When Paul speaks of Jesus, for a primary example here in Romans chapter 1, we see here starting in verse 3, and I know I'm cutting some stuff in half, but concerning his son, who was born of a descendant, and that word is spermatos, where we get sperm, born of a descendant of David according to the flesh, and according to kata sarka, let's see, is it sarka? Sarka. And kata is according to, and sarka is obviously a form of flesh there. Mm-hmm. Now, in other cases where Paul is talking about just believers in general, or he's talking about sinful nature, he uses the same word, flesh. And so it seemed to me reasonable to conclude that Paul, in speaking of his main point here, which is Jesus, if he's going to be talking about his flesh at all, and this Romans 1:3 verse isn't the only example of this, he would have some other category. He would have another way of talking about, you know, Christ. When I say flesh, I mean like this kind of thing, instead of referring to his nature, his fleshly nature here in verse 3. And in fact, he makes the distinction, the descendant of David according to the flesh, who was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead, according to the Spirit of holiness. And so it seems that he's making a fairly clear statement here of the two natures of Christ. And
it, however, like, if you'll read that passage again, and by the way, I don't know Carrier's argument on this point well enough to defend it, but this is a side jaunt. But if you read that passage again, you'll notice something very interesting. That passage does not support the gospel accounts. That passage is advocating an early form of Christian doctrine called adoptionism, which said that, which is the same thing that occurs in the hymn in Philippians, which says that Jesus was a man who God adopted because of his faithfulness and made him a son of God as the first of many adoptions that is going to happen with you and I and the rest of the church.
Yeah, I've got the Price New Testament here. It says, sprung from the line of David according to flesh, miraculously appointed Son of God according to the Spirit of holiness by a resurrection of the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. And I get where you're going there, John. The argument here with Carrier is slightly different from just the overall mythicist position, but it is sort of counter orthodox historicity in that sense. So, yeah, I mean, there are allowances that can be made for the by the flesh, and that can be accepted into that reading of Paul, without it being a full on historicity type of deal. But you know, finish what you were saying about that anyway.
Well, that was really my main point.
Okay,
I had spent a lot of time going through that in Metzger's commentary, and looking at different manuscript evidence and seeing, you know, okay, well, there's flesh here and there's this talking about Jesus, and which manuscripts and uncials and all this stuff, where do those things occur? Is it early? Is it late? Some of it's early, some of it's late. I couldn't really find anything that would build a case for that talk about Jesus being late. So I don't see a good reason to conclude that it was some later addition in terms of Orthodox thought. On Price's reading there, I mean, I think that it's a grammatical point here. Where do you put that comma? Where do you order it? And that sort of thing. I'd have to look at that more closely, but that's a different point. That's mostly what I had time to look at was, that's an initial point, I guess, maybe later to be more revised into a fuller account of why I think that Paul actually had.
No, it's a decent argument to make that there are definitely passages that
that we find in Paul that do point to the concept of Jesus being a fleshly creature at some point in time. I don't think that's under dispute at all.
Okay, then maybe I'm misunderstanding the point that Carrier was making.
Well, the main thrust of his argument in The Empty Tomb with that big chapter is that Paul may have believed that there was an historical Jesus, a man who lived and died, but that what rose was not the Jesus in the Gospels. It was not the Jesus that appeared and said, you know, touch my side and see that it's me. That the Jesus that resurrected was a spirit being, and that the historical person died when his body was killed. Not to say that that's, you know, at the crucifixion with Pontius Pilate and all that that we read in the Gospels, but that there was some fleshly person
died somewhere. Yeah.
Sometime somewhere died, and that when he resurrected, it was as a celestial being and it became Christ at that point. So it's kind of a different take on things. And you're right, Paul is very creative, and I don't know if we see anything quite like this anywhere else aside from, I guess, some of the other mystery religions. But it is, I mean, when you look at it,
like I said, there's an early what it was, second century major dispute that lasted all the way up to the Council of Nicaea, and it's one of the reasons that the virgin birth is in the Nicene Creed, because it was a dispute among Christian theologians about whether Jesus was God from birth, or whether he became God at his baptism, or whether he became God at his resurrection. And if you read the patristics, there are plenty of counter arguments between them about this, and that's one of the key reasons that the Council of Nicaea was called, was to solve the problem of what Jesus actually was.
Yeah, people had and you know, a lot of people get confused about the whole mythicist thing that, you know, was, they sort of confuse it with the whole Da Vinci argument. You know, the Da Vinci Code.
Completely different thing.
That it's actually the opposite. The Da Vinci Code argues that Jesus was just a regular guy who was embellished into this god. Whereas the mythicist position argues that, well, he was actually probably originally a god that became euhemerized into an actual historical person. So it was kind of like the exact opposite.
Remembered, yeah, and particularly a god who became remembered as a man, as part of a tradition of Midrash and creating mnemonic device to remember his teachings. It's easier to remember a story which has a point, like the pericopes in the gospel, than it is to remember a saying that one guy said. You're in a primarily oral culture. It's a more efficient way to transmit information.
Right on. Yeah, Zach, I have your book. I don't know why I didn't reference it for this question.
Check out that, I can't remember, I believe it's section four. It's a huge, it's a book in its own right, what he put in there for that. But I think it's check out section four or five, one of those, and he really gets into this, what we're going to cover. If you can stick around for it, I'll mention, the germ of his argument there. At least the thing that I found most meaningful from his argument was the seed analogy.
Now, who are we talking about here? So I'm clear.
Carrier. This is Carrier's argument about the spiritual body of Jesus.
Okay.
He used the seed analogy in 1 Corinthians, or he mentions the seed analogy that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is talking about the resurrection of the dead. He says, you know, how are the dead raised? What kind of body do they come in? He says, you fool, that which you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And that which you sow, you do not sow the body which is to be, but a bare grain, perhaps of wheat or something else. So he's using this analogy of a seed. And Carrier makes the argument that this is how he conceived of Christ's resurrection, that there was a man at some point who went into the ground, and the shell sloughed off. It, you know, it broke off, whatever. And what was inside was this spiritual being that was raised up. And this is, and the reason why this is contentious is because in the Gospels, of course, especially in John, where we have this this huge emphasis on the physicality of the risen Christ, the Jesus that is resurrected is, you know, you can touch him, he eats fish, you know, he walks around, you can put your hand in his side. I mean, it's a very physical thing, even though for whatever reason he's walking through walls. And there's a huge amount of theological hay that's been worked on.
Now, just to be clear, I don't think he was walking through walls in John, was he? He was walking through walls in Matthew.
Well, he appeared in the room.
Oh, that's right. He appeared in the middle of the room. Okay.
So it doesn't say that he walked through the wall, but, you know, somehow he appeared there and, you know. But, you know, so there's a lot of theological hay that's been worked over to try to explain how Jesus's spiritual body and Paul's conception of the spiritual body, because obviously it comes from that, how that actually works, how when you are resurrected, you have a physical body that is spiritual. And this is, you know, this is often one of those things that's sort of attributed to, well, mystery, or, you know, we can't understand it completely until we get resurrected. But just as a concept, it seems just completely at odds with itself until you sort of look at this in 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is talking about the body being raised as a seed. It's sown a perishable body. It's raised an imperishable body. And when you sow a seed, the shell is what you see. This is what Carey argues, that the shell is what you see. And so the corollary to that is our body, our physical body. So that dies. That's our shell. And there's something inside of that you can't see. And so that would be our spiritual essence, that, you know, it's comparable to what the stars are made of. That is what is resurrected. And so Carey makes that argument. Of course, you know, this argument is in the empty tomb, because he's arguing why, you know, the empty tomb was not necessary for Pauline theology. Because, of course, Paul could say, well, yeah, of course, you can have a body in a tomb, but that you're not talking about the Jesus that was raised.
Right.
Yeah, that's, you know, you're talking about the wrong thing. That's not Christ Jesus. That's the old Jesus' body. That is not what I worship. I worship the thing that was raised, the spiritual essence that was inside, that is now, you know, at the right hand of God.
Yeah,
exalted. And there is, just as a side note to that, Dan's mentioned this a number of times, but I want to bring this up again. In Philippians 2, you have this hymn that is repeated and may actually be very, very ancient, one of the earliest strata of Christianity. But it talks about Jesus who had an appearance as a man, who humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. For this reason also God highly exalted him. So because of the death on the cross, God exalted this man and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee will bow, blah 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 blah. So this sort of feeds into the same thing that we're sort of picking up on in 1 Corinthians 15, that there is this man that Paul is thinking of that was exalted by God and given the name Jesus, so that the name Jesus really is not the proper name. It's really a title. And of course, it just means God is with us. So it could be a title. And so this,
Emmanuel means God is with us.
Jesus, oh, I'm sorry. Means it means God, God saves.
Messiah.
God saves. Yeah. Yahweh saves. Joshua. That's the actual name of it, yeah. not Jesus. But so so we're not talking exactly about the same thing as the corollaries between Jesus and, you know, these other mythic, you know, saviors. What we're saying here is that the way that Paul conceived of him was not historical, that there was this man at some point in time, and he never really connects him.
Let's be clear here. The way Paul conceived of Jesus Christ, the Savior, was not as the being that walked the earth, but as the being who was made of him.
Right, but he also never connects him with the historical Jesus of the Gospels. Right,
yeah.
So that's the important point that needs to be made about this particular aspect of it, and not that, you know. and of course, I'm not arguing for Paul. I'm not saying that he was right, but I'm saying that he had a conception of Jesus that was very much at odds with the historical Jesus as portrayed in the Gospels. I guess that's really what I want to get across. So, now, is there anything about that you don't understand, John? Because I think I'm there, but I might not be completely. You'd really have to get Carrier on the phone.
Yeah. No, I picked up what you're saying. I misunderstood, I guess, what we had, what was written down here in the Google document. I misread, so I'm gonna have to go back over this and.
And there's the argument you were rebutting is actually an argument made by Earl Doherty, who holds that Paul didn't believe in any Jesus ever being physical of any sort, and I like his book, but I think he reaches a bit too far. I don't think you can quite prove the case.
Well, good. I'm glad that I was able to rebut somebody.
Yeah.
So, dang it. I'd like to be a little fresher, though. It's not going to, I can't just attack the old guys. I'm going to have to get after Carrier, too.
Well, yeah. Well. But, well, it's honestly a lot to keep in your head at one time, and we've gone. I mean, I don't know how many hours we've been doing this now, all told. I mean, probably close to five or six hours. And we haven't even really been. I mean, we've tried to be fairly comprehensive, but you could do a much better job of it. So there's a lot to deal with here, a lot to wrap your mind around, a lot to consider, and definitely we're not done. I think we've gone through the arguments from ahistoricity pretty well, and we've gone through most of the other arguments, the arguments from silence, the arguments from similarity. So, they're on the table. We basically know what they are. We know what we're dealing with, and it's this basically ends almost our survey of the Jesus myth hypothesis. But
yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I do think that enough has been placed on the table that despite having looked at just about everything, there's still a lot of discussion to be made from this.
Yeah.
So definitely next time on Apologia, we'll be getting into this more and a lot of discussion points. And don't feel bad about not getting everything today, because we'll definitely have some more to talk about later. And so just
I got a definite request, Zach.
Sure.
When we wrap this up next time, us atheists have kind of dominated the discussion for the last.
Yeah, I know.
I think it's their turn to pick a topic and put us on the defensive for a while.
Absolutely. Here. So you, John, you and Kevin get together with something and keep me in. Dan on our toes mm-hmm. for a little while.
Yeah, and whether it's theological or whether it's ethical, I think we could have a lot of fun being on the defensive for a change.
Yeah, well, John and I were actually having we were talking a little while ago about some possible ideas, and they sounded kind of promising. So those would be kind of interesting, actually. I think so. We'll see if those might work out in the near future. Cool. But until then, just take this, re-listen to this, re-listen to some of the other ones if you want to go over them again. Read through your Bible, go through some of these things that have been mentioned, some of these passages, verses, read up Richard Carrier, read up Bob Price, and, double check what they're saying and ruminate on it. We'll take a little bit of a break between now and the next time we get together. And we'll definitely have some good discussion next time.
Okay. Yeah, so. It's funny. I always want to, I guess in the philosophical vein, I always want to master whatever it is that I'm looking at. But I had to remind myself all this stuff is really only about a little over a month old to me. So.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and we've got you on a serious disadvantage because we've each been reading up on this for about 4 years now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're basically just, shining the flashlight in your face and, trying to see how...
Ooh, yeah. You're gonna do this.
What do you think about this? I don't know.
Yeah, so no worries. We'll definitely get to it all on next time on Apologia. So thanks, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Okay.
Let me just pop in this.